in the case of Peterson against Gibson.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. In the case of Perez versus G. Frank Oldsmobile, this Court said that no reasonable person or sensible person spends $236,000 in attorney's fees in pursuit of a $34,500 claim, or even treble that amount of $163,500. We submit respectfully, Your Honor, that in this case, the District Court award of $288,000 in fees and over $20,000 in costs was an abuse of discretion, where the plaintiff rejected a $25,000 offer of judgment from defendant Gibson, made a $60,000 settlement demand only as to defendant Gibson.
Did you make in the district court an argument that the settlement qualified under Rule 68?
The reason we did not is that at that point, I think we touched on that, but at that point the plaintiff's argument was that their fees exceeded $25,000 by January of 2000, by the time we made the offer of judgment.
In any event, you're not making a Rule 68 argument here.
You know,
I don't understand what significance the settlement could have, the settlement offer could have, except as a part of a Rule 68 offer.
Well, I think under the Cole case, under the Cartwright case, the cases where if the offer is made and the offer is reasonable and a reasonable evaluation of the claim and the plaintiff rejects it, then the plaintiff subsequently accepts an amount that is the amount of that offer or less. It's a suggestion that the plaintiff is not the prevailing party or that the recovery is technical or de minimis, because the plaintiff could have settled the case earlier for the same amount but didn't, and in the interim incurred substantial attorney fees. In this case, the plaintiff, after at trial, made a demand of $160,000 to settle as to all defendants, proceeded to trial, and obtained a $1 verdict against defendant Gibson. After that, an order was entered granting a new trial as to damages against Gibson, and following that, the case was settled for $10,000 as to Gibson.
Now, given that the retrial would have involved different jury instruction regarding damages, is there any indication that those jury instructions would have resulted in a significantly greater damage award against Officer Gibson?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the jury instruction simply suggested to the jury that it may award $1 if it found that the civil rights of the plaintiff had been violated by defendant Gibson, but that there were no meaningful damages resulting therefrom.
Well, but in other words, can we tell whether that $10,000 settlement amount reflected the cost of defending a retrial on damages, or if it reflected the potential for a jury to award significantly higher damages on retrial?
I think, Your Honor, that what we've shown in the brief is that the expenses to try the case on the defense side exceeded $10,000, and therefore, at least from our perspective, the $10,000 was offered to avoid a retrial. And under Fisher versus Kelly, I think that that is a technical or de minimis recovery, and the plaintiff is not the prevailing party. The fees were awarded by the district court after having found in its order granting a new trial that the jury was reasonable in awarding a small amount of damages as to defendant Gibson. The court noted in its order that Gibson was courteous and respectful during the course of the arrest, and that lessened the traumatic effect of the arrest, and that the detention of the plaintiff following the arrest was attributable to the Mario Tecoci defendants for not coming down to the police station, and that the false arrest was completed in a couple of hours while the malicious prosecution extended over 7 months. And the fees were also awarded in this case by the district court, who had recommended himself that the case settle globally as to all defendants for a total of $100,000 inclusive of all attorney fees and costs. Under these circumstances, we submit that the plaintiff is not the prevailing party. A plaintiff who accepts a settlement figure significantly less than the settlement demand is not the prevailing party and is therefore not entitled to recover attorney fees under Fisher versus Kelly. There, the court found that a $7,500 settlement was nuisance value compared to an $80,000 settlement demand. Here we have a settlement demand just as to defendant Gibson of $60,000 and a settlement then of $10,000. We submit that it is nuisance value under Fletcher versus City of Fort Wayne, where there were two plaintiffs. One made a demand of $150,000 and accepted a $5,000 offer of judgment. Another plaintiff demanded $30,000 and settled for $2,500. This court affirmed the district court's decision to award no attorney fees, concluding that the best way to determine the degree of a plaintiff's success in a settlement is to compare the plaintiff's settlement demand with the amount for which the case was settled. And this court also said that a settlement for less than the cost of defense is a good definition of a nuisance value settlement. In this case, the cost of defense, as I said, to prepare and try the case were more than $10,000, and therefore the settlement amount exceeded the cost of defense and, under this court's definition in Fletcher, was a nuisance value settlement. We also submit that the plaintiff's recovery in this case is merely technical or de minimis. Under Justice O'Connor's three-part test in Farrar, the most significant part of that test is the difference between the amount recovered and the damages sought. And in this case, we believe that gap is significant. The other two factors in this case also favor the defendant because the legal issue on which the plaintiff prevailed is merely a Fourth Amendment false arrest claim. There's nothing unusual or spectacular about this false arrest claim that differentiates it from all of the others. And there was no public purpose to this litigation, which satisfies the third part. This court has said in Mall and in Cartwright that where there's no injunctive relief and no punitive damages, and the plaintiff is seeking only compensatory damages for herself, there is no public purpose to the litigation. Now, in this case, the plaintiff did obtain a $1 verdict from the jury, but we do not believe that that
offers... Certainly didn't obtain a $1 verdict. It was vacated by the district judge.
Right, and the reason I bring that up is that I think the plaintiff's argument is that in this case is that this case is distinguishable from Fisher versus Kelly because here the plaintiff did obtain a judgment from a jury. And I would submit that the fact that the plaintiff obtained a judgment doesn't change the analysis.
The plaintiff did not obtain a judgment.
Okay, then I'll accept that.
The jury returned a verdict, and the district judge held that that verdict was infected by legal error, and no judgment was rendered on the verdict.
Then the case is simply one that settled for $10,000. And if you look at the case from that perspective, a case settling for $10,000 where the demand was $60,000, the recovery is de minimis. The recovery does not render the plaintiff the prevailing party under Fisher versus Kelly. In Volca versus...
Did anybody put to the district courts a question whether the outcome here meets the standards of Buchanan for being a prevailing plaintiff?
No, Your Honor. No. I think that... The focus was Fisher versus Kelly because...
No, Buchanan holds that to be a prevailing party, you have to recover a judgment. And one might think that since the district court vacated the jury's verdict and no judgment ever ensued, that Buchanan would have considerable bearing on this case.
Well, if it does, then the case is simply, again, one that just settled for $10,000, irrespective of any verdict that had been vacated. So then I think Fisher versus Kelly is the prevailing decision, which would guide this court to say that the recovery by the plaintiff is both de minimis and the plaintiff is not the prevailing party. The issue of the fees attributable to the Mario Tricocci claim, we believe those fees on that claim are not recoverable from or attributable to defendant Gibson. That was a separate claim. That claim was not subject to a fee-shifting statute. And according to the district court, Mario Tricocci's conduct was the primary, if not the sole, cause of the plaintiff's damages. And under Zabkowicz, if the state claim or the non-fee-shifting claim could be brought separately, then the plaintiff is not entitled to recover attorney's fees incurred in that claim from a companion 1988 defendant. And that's what we have here. The claim against Mario Tricocci certainly could have been brought separately. The plaintiff could have settled the case with Gibson and pursued the case solely against Mario Tricocci. The problem for the plaintiff under those circumstances would be that the plaintiff could not turn to defendant Gibson at the conclusion of the case and try to recover all of the fees incurred in both claims. We believe that what the plaintiff is suggesting in this case is that a successful plaintiff on a non-fee-shifting state claim against one defendant may recover fees incurred in that claim against a 1988 defendant who settles with the plaintiff for an amount that is less than one-fourth of the recovery on the non-fee-shifting claim. That would encourage plaintiffs to refuse to accept reasonable settlements made by marginally liable 1988 defendants while pursuing the companion claim against the other more culpable defendants, and then at the end of the case turning to the 1988 defendant to recover all fees. In this case, if the plaintiff is the prevailing
party... You're not arguing that Mario Triaci didn't pay.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You're not arguing that the beauty salon didn't pay fees, are you?
They did not pay fees.
Not a cent in fees?
No. They were found liable only on the state claim. And punitive damages as well. Their total recovery from Mario Triaci was settled at $47,750.
But some of that surely went for fees.
Oh, certainly. How they divided that amount, I don't know. But it was a recovery made, certainly. Finally, if the plaintiff is the prevailing party in this case, then we believe that the fees should be reduced to reflect the simplicity of the case and the results achieved. Under City of Riverside, the result obtained is a significant factor in determining whether the fee award, especially in this amount, is supported by the facts of the case. And in Cole versus Wojcik, this court said that where the recovery is low enough in relation to the demand, the district court may disregard the lodestar apparatus and choose an appropriate fee by other means, such as awarding attorney's fees that are a percentage of the plaintiff's recovery. We believe that's what would be appropriate here if the plaintiff is the prevailing party, to be awarded a percentage of the plaintiff's recovery. And with that, I will...
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DiArno. Mr. Miner.
May it please the court. Let me first just remind the court that we're here on abuse of discretion standard. This case was tried for 6 years before Judge Zagel. Judge Zagel saw all of what happened in this case, and what he basically concluded, and what is clear from the record, is that Officer Gibson has no one to blame but himself for the predicament he found himself in. First, just on the basic facts of this case...
Let me tell you what my problem is. The dispositive opinion here, so far as I know, is Justice Powell's opinion in Riverside against Rivera. It's necessary to create a majority. And he thought that the award there was the very outer limit of what could be sustained and was sustainable only because of the great public benefit of the precedent created by the lawsuit. In this case, the recovery is lower, the fees are higher, and there was no precedent, and therefore one would think no public benefit attributable to precedent. Given Justice Powell's view, which is the one we have to follow, is the swing vote in a 5-4 case, what follows?
Well, let me suggest a couple of responses to that. First of all, the recovery here, this is a case that grows out of one common set of facts, and it pursues one common pool of damages. And there are two claims that go to that pool of damages. The 1983 wrongful arrest and detention case and the malicious prosecution case. What Judge Zagel properly found was that all of the time that went into this case, which was a bitterly contested lawsuit, was all related to that goal and all applied to the claim against Officer Gibson, and that the recovery here, in fact, was $60,000. Now, we were in a situation based on the instructions that were given and the circumstances of the case that at the time we entered into settlement discussions, a jury had already said $50,000 is the value we assess for the time period from the time they filed the complaint to the time that our client really recovered. So now we are trying to settle the remainder of the case, and we settled on two terms. We settled on the grounds that we would get $10,000 for that piece, and secondly, that we would get our fees and costs. That was our agreement, either by working it out or by...
Mr. Miner, you're not really addressing my problem.
But Judge,
I asked a question about the legal standards.
Well, I think here Judge Stengel makes a finding. He goes into the analysis that's suggested in Riverside, and he says, I have to look at three things at least.
I wish he did. He didn't cite Riverside.
Well, but he does the analysis. He makes it clear that he recognizes, because this is clearly a fee that is substantially larger than the recovery from Officer Gibson and even from for the entire case, I'm going to look at three things. First, I'm going to look at the tangible benefits she got, and he analyzes, and he points out that they are quite substantial. And there are plenty of cases that have been found by this circuit and others where $10,000 alone have been found to be enough to justify a full fee, but here she won $60,000. Number two, Judge Zagel, who we know is a former chief of police for the state of Illinois, made a specific finding. He looked at the second component, and he said, this case has, based on my experience and what I know, some very significant social benefit, and that is that this is a very unique and troublesome kind of police abuse. It's the using of police power to help a private company.
I don't see how the settlement of a case can have precedential benefits.
Well, there was a judgment in this case in which the jury found that the police officer
the judgment was set aside.
And the new judgment was ultimately entered. A judgment was entered in this case. This is not a case without a judgment. This is a case when we entered our settlement, we entered a judgment. The court entered a judgment. There's a judgment incorporating these findings and giving us the $10,000 plus the settlement that was going to pursue attorney's fees from the court.
The finding of liability against Gibson was never set aside.
Pardon?
The finding of liability against Gibson was never set
Boy,
aside.
Boy, I sure don't understand that to be the case. The jury found that Gibson, engaged in an illegal arrest and a wrongful detention, and that the only issue that came before the judge was whether the verdict of a $1 nominal award was consistent with this record, and Judge Zagel said, I blew it. I should never have given this instruction. Indeed, he had made it clear that he gave the instruction for a very limited purpose. Namely, he thought that one of the salon people was sort of peripheral and maybe that person might get stuck. And he said, I blew it, and I'm going to give you a retrial. And I will use judgment here. Now, the question is, could we have gone after him for more?
The retrial is only going to be on the issue of damages.
That's right.
Liability.
Right. That's right. He made that clear.
Civil rights were not violated by Officer Gibson.
Pardon?
The finding that her rights were violated by Officer Gibson was never disturbed.
No, that is firmly established. And we then got a judgment for the entire amount after we reached the settlement rather than indeed go to trial. And what was left at that time, had we gone to prior to the judgment, we could have sued Officer Gibson alone. And his exposure would have been the same amount. We took both of these trains toward that damage. The jury said we're going to assess $50,000 of this damage against the salon for what occurred, all of the medical testimony was resulted because of Gibson's conduct. Gibson's arrest and handcuffing this woman, marching across the mall with her hands behind her back. This is a professional woman. Handcuffing her to a bench for a couple of hours while he waited for a salon person to find the time to come and find the complaint. Caused this woman,
were there hair and curlers?
Well, she had four. So she had left because the woman had left her under a one of those items. Don't go to salons, but one of those heating things, and she had burned her scalp, and she couldn't find the woman, and there was nobody at the front desk, so she left. And she came back voluntarily when the police officer said, would you come back and work this out? And she said, sure, I'll come back and work it out. And she agreed to pay something. She wouldn't pay 100%. There was no question this was a consumer dispute. The salon said, we want her arrested, we want 100%, and the cop agreed. And he arrested her, and he did all this, and all the medical testimony was this caused a profound traumatic reaction that really two doctors wanted to hospitalize her. It all occurred for about a 3 or 4 day period immediately afterwards. She recovered. No one argued that she's still suffering trauma from this, but there was no question that this woman suffered a very profound traumatic response from what the doctors called the confinement and the helplessness caused by what Officer Gibson had done. So, and that verdict was left, that part of the judgment was left standing, that he violated her rights, and that he had plenty of opportunity to settle this case. I mean, the judge looked at this case and said, after he had resolved the motions to dismiss, and he had been through all the discovery fights, He looked at it. He met with us for a long period of time. He asked us to produce our time records. And then he asked the parties, would you like me to make a recommendation on what I think this case is worth? And we said yes, and he proposed $100,000. And we accepted $100,000. We told him we would accept it. And they decided that.
Including all attorneys.
That was including all of our fees and everything. And we said, fine. But they took a risk. They said, no, we're not going to accept it. And then they called back, they make an offer of judgment of $25,000, knowing that fees and costs at that point are well beyond $25,000. This is months after the judge's offer and after we've been into another round of briefing and discovery. And then they call us and say, well, would you settle with us alone? And we say, sure. Here's our time. Here's what we've done. And we propose $60,000, and they don't respond. They didn't make a counter proposal. They don't do anything. They choose to try the case, and they lost. And then they settled on the grounds that we were going to submit our fee issue, which they knew was substantial. There was no question about this. They could go to trial. They knew at that time they had spent at least $500 on this case, and they had spent a lot of costs, and they knew that the Ferrari had carried the open war in what were most of the bitter fights in this case. Unfortunately, this became a bitterly contested lawsuit. We didn't put out a suggestion in this record that we did one thing to promote fees, to increase our fees, that we sent two lawyers to a single deposition. We did nothing. We responded for 5 years to a lawsuit from parties that just were not going to sit down and work out a settlement. And we defended our clients, and we won. And Judge Zagel looked at all of the data and said, A, this time was all reasonably spent, and he awarded us, he considered every argument that they raised, and he awarded us our fee. We submitted, though, pardon? I'm sorry. He made one error that we think is abuse of discretion, and that comes to our rates. Having gone through, while Judge Zagel's opinion is clearly a short opinion, Judge Zagel, in fact, deals with every issue that one expects. This court keeps saying these things are not supposed to explode into second trials, and that's what they tried to turn it into. They challenged every entry of our time. They argued that we weren't even a prevailing party, notwithstanding we had a judgment, we'd won everything. Anyway, Judge Zagel goes through this. He does get to the rate issue, and for some reason, in a case in which we had set forth our rates, in which we had offered all of the traditional documentation that one, we do only contingent work, we offered all of the traditional documentation that one can offer. An affidavit from myself as a senior partner in the law firm explaining what our fee structure is and how we bill. We had, I think, I want to say 10 or 12 declarations from lawyers in Chicago, both about the quality of our work, having reviewed what we had done, and what the general structure of rates is in the city of Chicago. We even had a survey of what rates are in the city of Chicago. And we put all of that in. We put in opinions. Opinions that dealt with not just our own particular rates, but rates in our firm, because we do have a law firm, and our law firm has a structure. And so when courts rule on the rates of any of my partners, so just they're really ruling on the structure of our rate system. And if you look at our rate system versus all the affidavits, we are at the bottom of the range, but we certainly are within the range of what all these lawyers say are going.
You might want to spend some of your time on the cost. I'd particularly like you to address the question whether the witnesses can be, whether costs of more than $40 a day are appropriate for the witnesses.
Well, as I explained out briefly, I think the answer is there is no authority in this circuit on that issue. The majority of district courts.
But is there any statutory authority?
Well,
statute says $40 a day.
For testifying experts. But this judge ruled, and we all had a big fight in this lawsuit, that these were not testifying experts, that these were treating doctors and that they were not being brought in as experts. And there is a wealth of case law that says under those circumstances they're entitled to their time. The issue is whether Judge Zagel abuses discretion in following.
Is there any appellate decision that you're relying on?
I don't believe there is an appellate decision out. I think these are decisions that have mostly gone to the district courts and have not.
Did any of them, by the way, involve testimonial witnesses?
Oh, I think so. I checked.
The cases you cite involve non-testimonial witnesses. They involve fees for time during depositions of non-testimonial witnesses where the depositions were conducted over the opposition of the opposing party.
Well, let me tell you what happened here. We certainly took the deposition of one of these experts over.
No, you're not grasping the significance of this.
I'm sorry. The point here is that these were not expert witnesses, whether they ended up being called in the case to testify as treating physicians or not. The simple fact is that there is no circuit court authority to the contrary, and Judge Zagel, looking at the law, said, this is the way I rule, and the question is whether...
Actually, again, Judge Zagel didn't cite any of these cases. His whole order cites only one case, which has absolutely nothing to do with the problem at hand. It would have been better had... You would be in a stronger position had the district court actually analyzed it.
Let me tell Judge Zagel a little about the cost on this issue and how this all came up. Cost becomes very complicated. There's a lot of documentation. The cost issue came up because when we settled the case, and this was all on before Judge Jacob, we called opposing counsel and I said, why don't you come over here and sit down and let's go through and what do you object to and what don't you object to so that we then will focus our attention on the issues that you're concerned about. Let's just do that rather than deal with everything. Mr. Diallo was too busy and he never came over. We put forth our basic presentation, and we again said, come on, let's sit down and let's try to work this all out. Mr. Diano never came over. So finally, in reply, in a circumstance in which we had argued in part, you know, they really waived this argument. They have not offered themselves anything in opposition to this, and in fact, we should get the costs that we want. We presented the case law, and Judge Zagel ruled our way, and the case law supports him. I'm not sure, I guess, why the issue isn't whether there is plenty of case law that supports him, and if there is, whether his ruling then could be an abuse of discretion. I think that on that one issue, I don't know of very many cases that go the other way for testifying non-experts, but rather for treating physicians during the course of the lawsuit. So, you know, I guess my view is there is support for his position and an abuse of discretion standard that precludes the conclusion that no reasoned person could possibly have ruled as Judge Zagel did.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Miner. Anything further, Mr. Diano?
With respect to the cross appeal where the district court reduced the hourly rate, under Small versus Richard Wolf, the district court is entitled to determine the probative value of each submission in support of the fee petition and must arrive at its own determination as to a proper fee. And under Miller versus Artistic Cleaners, this court said that the district court's direct observations of the attorney's performance supersedes the affidavits of local counsel regarding the reputation and rates of that lawyer. Insofar as the reply to the my argument, the fact that there was a liability finding against Gibson, certainly that remained, that was not vacated. However, that is not the significant factor in determining whether the plaintiff's recovery in this case is nuisance value settlement or is a technical or de minimis recovery. Under the three-part test, the primary point to look at is the difference between the demand and the settlement amount actually recovered. And in this case, as in Perez, I believe that gap is so wide that it in itself reflects the abuse of discretion.
See, the problem here is nothing would have happened if Gibson would have come in and said, oh, this is a civil dispute, whether she owes us money or not. You go your way and you guys work it out. So Gibson's action got the whole, to use the train analogy, going down the track here.
That's true. He made the arrest, and there was a verdict against him. That was vacated, and we settled the case for $10,000. The question is, and I think it was addressed by the district court, the damages in this case were primarily due to the conduct of Mario Tricocci. The district court found that in the order granting a new trial when he said that Gibson was courteous and respectful during the arrest.
Arrest that person.
And police officer.
Arrest that person.
Right. We're not contesting the liability issue in this case. I mean, what we're contesting is the award of $288,000 for a $10,000 settlement.
Thank you very much to all counsel. The case is taken under